Hello and welcome to the Home Assistant Podcast. This is episode 2021.4. As usual, I have Phil. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Rohan. How's it going?
Good.
This episode is sponsored by Home Assistant Cloud by Nebucasa. Easily access your local Home Assistant instance remotely for a small monthly fee that supports the Home Assistant project. Configuration is done by the user interface, so there's no fiddling with router settings, SSL certificates, or any YAML.
This episode is sponsored by morebeer.com. For over 25 years, they've helped creative people like you create your own beer, wine, or coffee at home. Find out more at morebeer.com. Listeners of the show can save $10 off their first order using promo code HASPODCAST. That's H-A-S-S podcast in one word. Jumping right into it, Phil, 2021.4. First and foremost, Home Assistant Analytics. Have you seen some of the charts there?
No, I haven't yet, but it does look cool. I've literally just installed the beta. We're about to flick on the analytics. I saw that, they've been such a, because we're obviously testing Home Assistant during the beta. There's been a lot of people that have just flicked it on anyway, and they've actually had a whole bunch of data coming through, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. So basically, for those listening, so if you don't know what it is, essentially Home Assistant can send back anonymized data from your instance. Now, just when you're reading the release notes, you'll notice they do talk about privacy. They do talk about all this stuff. You know, don't freak out. It is, again, it's an opt-in. And if you don't want to do that, don't do it. But again, all of that stuff is open source. That's not coming from any other closed source places. So I was actually just reading the release notes not that long ago, and they're just saying, you know what, go check the code, jump in and
audit it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. They're encouraging you to turn it on. And if you don't want to, that's cool. But essentially what happens is they send some telemetry, again, anonymized telemetry back to Home Assistant, i.e. the developers. And essentially what they can figure out is, you know, how are people deploying Home Assistant? How is it used? That kind of thing, so that they can actually process these updates and things like that a lot faster, a lot better. Maybe not faster, but just at least focus on what needs to be focused on, right? So as an example, if nobody is using one specific way of installing, so for example, I use Home Assistant on a container. If nobody's using Home Assistant on containers, well, maybe they'll look at deprecating that platform, or maybe they'll look at, you know, converting that to something else down the road. Mm. So, you know, it does help. The analytics are freely available, so you can go to analytics.homeassistant.io and check it out there, and actually see the data and see that tabulated data. So it is actually pretty interesting.
Yeah, so it's obviously running right now around for beta users, and very interesting. So so this is obviously very skewed to people that are on the bleeding edge, like you and I, and the developers that, you know, go in and try and get it into a week early. But, you know, 49.5% of users running the beta are running Home Assistant via the operating system. And mm-hmm. only, you know, a quarter of people are running Home Assistant via a Docker container. The average number of entities running in Home Assistant, remember this is all skewed to those beta users, is 380, and the average number of automations is 39. Now, when I flick on my integration with analytics, I'm sure that average number of automations is going to spike a little bit more. But there's 82 average integrations, and, you know, the Amazon Echo installation has 227 installations. Google Cast is very popular. MQTT is up there. So this is all data that I can't wait to see once people start upgrading and it starts getting into real world cases. We're interesting to see what's the average number of automations people are running, you know, like what are people running Home Assistant on, you know, and what integrations are people, you know, are using, and what's the most popular? Because I think that data alone will be able to assist the developers a lot, you know, where to focus, you know, for example, the Philips Hue integration, I can't see that at the moment on this list. That doesn't need to say that once, you know, things go live, that the Philips Hue integration won't jump to the first place, right? And in that case, you know, if Philips Hue is number one, then Home Assistant will need to put in, you know, more resources to make sure that that integration is rock solid, and that, you know, any breaking change that comes out to the Philips Hue integration needs to be managed better, because it's going to affect the most amount of people. So this is where that sort of information becomes really powerful.
Sure, sure, exactly. And even from there, it's actually pretty cool. I'm just clicking around as you're saying this. You know, even internal integrations, it's interesting because, you know, obviously some things like authentication and stuff is turned on for everybody always.
Yep.
But then you start seeing, hey, you know what? System health. Not everybody has system health. Actually, as of this point, if the numbers I'm looking at, it's exactly one person has system health turned off. It's things like that, right? Which is pretty interesting. Again, webhooks are among the top installations. The Amazon Echoes, Home Assistant Cloud, and things like that too. So it's actually pretty interesting, right? You can start to see, okay, what are people doing? And, you know, right now I'm seeing, you know, number 63 is FFmpeg, and I'm starting to get curious what people are doing with that. As in, why are there this many people using that, right? So, you know, how useful is this data to you and me, Phil? Probably not very, but it's still very interesting to see, I think. So,
and also, because this is all open source and, you know, it's made available publicly, there's nothing stopping, you know, other open source home automation projects or even... Yep. You know, your home automation products that are pegged, you know, like your Samsung SmartThings or your Fibaro Home Center controls. Totally. They can now go in and see what, you know, products are people using, what are the most popular sort of smart home integrations, and tailor, you know, systems for that. So it's a good way to give back to the home automation sphere in general, I think.
100%. Yeah.
So one thing to note, we actually spoke about something like this a long time ago, Mark. Thinking like a couple of years ago, it was originally an update to the Home Assistant Updater component. They would start pushing, you know, basic usage statistics back to Home Assistant. This has now been completely replaced because I think it just wasn't working. They weren't getting enough data. So this is a whole new integration that's been written just for this version. So, yeah.
So I wonder if that's getting deprecated.
It is. It's actually part of the breaking changes for this release. So the updated component, so there is a couple of parameters you could have. I think there was include, use components, and reporting. There were configuration options that were available in your YAML. They've now been deprecated. So if you have those, they won't do anything. You may as well just remove them from your YAML.
Perfect.
All right. So that was, yeah, so that's pretty big first one. Obviously not, you know, a feature that people are going to use every day. But one that has been added in is the ability to filter automations, scripts, and scenes based on the entities, the devices, and the areas that they are in. So this is something cool. So there's been a constant feature request to have the ability to organize, you know, automations and scripts into folders, right? And I don't know about you, Rohan, but I've started trying to name my automations and scripts in a certain convention. Yep. For example, like, you know, the room name first and then what it does and, you know, what action that's taking place.
Yeah,
just to try and, you know, so if I'm using the services area that I can get to the automation that I want, I know what it's going to be called, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I do like automation or notification, or like I kind of categorize them that way, right? And I don't go as deep as you do, but I try and categorize it at least so I can at least help filter down that way. So it'd be nice to have that kind of folder like effect, right? That you can have.
Yes. So now if you go into your configuration area and into the automation section, there's a new filter area up the top, and those filters allow you to now filter by the entity and the area and of course the device. It's not available in the developer tools that I can see. So if you rely on the states area to do anything like that, you won't find it there, but you can find it from that automations, scenes, and the scripts sections of the configuration panel.
Right. And speaking of automations, there's actually been a really, 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 I mean, from my perspective, I think this was one of the biggest things we were missing in automations, is the ability to debug automations. So if you're a programmer or you've programmed in the past or you're familiar with the concepts, you know, debugging is one of those things where you want to do things like, hey, how is it actually stepping through this automation? How is it actually, how is the automation actually working in real life rather than how I think it's working? So there's a lot of those kind of features that have kind of been brought in. And, you know, whether it's Paulus, Eric, Bram, Thomas, everybody's kind of collaborated and come up with some kind of a way to you know, see this and visualize it too as well, physically. So Paulus talked about this a little bit when we quizzed him about what was coming up. So, I mean, since we have you, Paulus, I mean, so switching tracks a little bit, from a home assistant perspective, where you know, what are some of your plans? What's happening? Where are things going?
That's a good question. So we are, I mean, home assistant is kind of chugging along nicely, right? It's happening. I think last year I mentioned Chip. That's something that definitely we need to start looking at. I had kind of thought that we already would be working on it, but it's things always come up. So, for example, one of the things that just came up is that we're adding tracing to automations. So until now, automations have really been a black box. They fire, you have to go into your logbook and see kind of what did happen, what just happened.
Right.
And now with tracing, and this is really a kind of developer term, but what it means is that you can actually see every step that was taken inside your automation, including like if you have an and condition, how each individual condition, you can actually look into it and see what were the variables that were available at this time, what was the result of this condition, and so you can see why did my automation not fire.
Right.
You can also see what actions happened, and then, you know, we introduced this concept of context like a year and a half or maybe 2 years ago. I don't fully remember. But with context, we can actually see which state changes happened because of this automation.
Right.
So now when you see your trace of like a timeline of how each action happened in your script or in the action part of your automation, we can actually see also the state changes that then happened in Home Assistant because of that. So if you have a long running in automation, for example, one that has like a wait for trigger, which is a which are the cooler one, like this cool concept that we added last year to have these long running automations. That's now very easy to debug because you can see, is this automation actually running? Because you can look at traces while they're being recorded.
Right.
And then you can see, oh yeah, it's still running and it's waiting for the next trigger to move on. And then, oh, this trigger took like 5 hours. And then these actions were happened as part of this automation.
Yeah, that's cool. Because I must say that like my entire, like whenever I've tried to work out why didn't an automation fire, it's always, all right, go and check conditions. And I have sprawling condition logic, right? Like, you know, there's an and group here and then that subgroup by an or over here and all that. So being able to like run a trace on those things is going to be like a game changer. Like it's going to empower so many, you know, different, you know, permutations of, you know, and clean, like reduce YAML because we can do much more complex automations now. And then, yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
And, you know, before this, people would always look at their log files and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a kind of an abuse of log files almost, right? Like, because now people had to know about logging and had to figure it all out. And so I really hope that with this, it will be really insightful.
So something we were also talking to Paulus last week about, Rohan, was the, you know, where things were going with Home Assistant and, you know, where the future will lie. And, you know, we started talking about, you know, trigger-based sensors. And for the first time in 2021.4, they've started the groundwork for this. I believe it starts with template entities. So there is the ability for, you know, template entities to be triggered based, you know, either from a webhook or something like that in Home Assistant. But it was really cool to see, you know, what Paulus has, you know, the future of this working from. So let's take a listen to what Paulus, you know, has big plans for this little feature.
So we've recently updated the REST integration. I don't know if you saw this or noticed this, but the REST integration used to be platform-based. So you had to do like, hey, sensor, platform, REST, and you define your REST endpoint. And then if you wanted to fetch the data from the same endpoint, you would have to define a second sensor, a second binary sensor. And so we were overloading REST endpoints, right? There was like, oh, there's like REST endpoints. Like now we're fetching the same endpoint 5 times.
Yeah.
And then actually we implemented a faster way of fetching the data. And then certain endpoints were hitting DDoS protection because we were making so many requests.
Yeah.
And so we've rewritten the REST integration in a recent release where you define one endpoint and then you define all the entities that are derived from this. So the sensors and binary sensors, and you define like the templates. That's, and so we fetch the data once and then we update all those entities.
That's
actually been an approach where we've been thinking like, yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
So until now, we told everybody always like, oh, here's template entities. And template entities, and we did a lot of work on it actually to make them, you know, last year, to make them super, like, be aware of what in the state machine they rely on. And so they can, when things are in the state machine, we can see if we have to update them. But then it's actually annoying because everything has to go through the state machine. And so if you see with a REST integration, we take the data from the source, you write exactly what you want to write and nothing else. And the beauty of something like the REST integration is that, and we don't do this yet, but we could provide blueprints. So there's a lot of REST endpoints in the world that you might want to turn into sensors and entities, but a lot of REST endpoints might want to be customized based on the city or if it's, for example, for weather.
And
of course, an integration, making it an integration is better, but not everybody is capable of doing that.
Yeah.
So as like a step towards making integrations, we could have people, for example, have a weather, I don't know, I'm just say like open weather blueprint that you put in your location. It will actually set up the REST integration to fetch from the right REST endpoint and create the right entities and done.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So that's kind of something we're exploring. And as part of that exploration, I actually just yesterday created like a prototype, which you were calling the trigger entity. And so whenever you have a trigger in an automation, a bunch of variables become available that the trigger was based on, right? So the trigger could be data sent to an MQTT topic or a webhook coming in with data. Now, if we take the same approach like REST, but then instead of a REST source, we have a trigger source and then allow you to create entities based on that. So for example, now it would be very easy to have a webhook being sent to Home Assistant turn into update like five entities, like a bunch of sensors, a bunch of binary sensors. There's some overlap because, of course, MQTT triggers, right, would then pretty much be the same as having MQTT sensors and topics. But I think that we're going to this is going to make it also a lot easier if we don't know yet in what shape this is going to come to Home Assistant. And definitely, well, I wouldn't say definitely, but probably not for April.
Yeah.
But it would, again, open up a lot of cool ways to turn an event-driven things like webhooks or motion detection events or topic messages into entities. And entities are usually better for, you know, entities are great for tracking history. Entities are great for inside dashboard, right? Because we cannot capture events so well on the dashboard because they happen and they're gone. So. And another cool thing about trigger entity would be sometimes we have motion detection events, but people want to say, hey, when motion is detected, actually consider motion detected for at least 20 seconds. So this is something that could be part of a trigger entity saying trigger whenever the trigger triggers, and then after 20 seconds, turn it off again, like have a timeout added to it.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. Okay, that's actually really cool.
It sort of allows Home Assistant to be receiving data coming in and creating entities as opposed to having to poll for things all the time, right?
Which exactly.
With that, right now you can do that with MQTT, but then once you set, you have to set up an MQTT broker and get all that working, right? Whereas that, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's been, you know, we've been, I think until now, whenever people wanted to do these kind of things, we always said, create an integration.
Mm. Yeah.
And that still will hold true. Like if you want to reach the most amount of people, if you want to make it as easy as possible, integration is the way to go.
Sure.
But I think that, you know, once we have these blueprints blueprints for trigger entities or just trigger entities to begin with, I think we can already get very far without integrations. And then once we see that something is popular, convert it into an integration.
Yeah.
So that way it's more accessible to more people. And also, I think, I mean, if something can be built using a trigger entity, I mean, maybe we should have just a wrapper for trigger entities to be wrapped up as integrations.
Sure. That would be kind of cool, Well, it breaks down that barrier between, you know, like somebody like me who has no idea how to create an integration, right?
Right.
And but I might know how to do the rest of it and take that and throw it in a wrapper, yeah. And boom.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's also going to help. Like we get often there's been vendors and they're like, we want to integrate with Home Assistant. I'm like, great. This is how you do it. They're like, no. What is your API? And I always say, no, Home Assistant, we don't have an API to create sensors and binary sensors and all that stuff because we don't want to add to the problem that we're trying to solve, right? If a vendor implements the Home Assistant API, that means that their data is still not accessible for the rest of the world, right? So instead, Home Assistant should speak the protocol of these vendors.
Yep.
And so if we allow them to make it easier to create a protocol that we then consume because we have things like a trigger entity or et cetera, I think that will definitely help also just get more stuff in Home Assistant, right? And I think that's what a lot of people want. They want to see all the stuff and then be able to automate on it. So the easier we make that for everybody to use it and contribute to, I think the better.
So in terms of new platforms, so everything we talked about so far is just within Home Assistant and you know, what the Home Assistant developers, the core developers have kind of been focused on. So in terms of what new, there are a couple of things. So first of all, the Panasonic Viera now has support, so that integration now has support for remotes.
Ooh, nice.
Mm-hmm. Also, Philips TV now has support for remotes, so kind of keeping on that same topic. So it's nice to see that these are coming in.
I remember when the remote component was very first created for the Logitech Harmony Hub. And it's just good to, that was like years ago now. Like, it's good to see that, you know, this remote component is finally starting to get some more TVs added in.
Oh, totally. And you know, there's a bunch that are already there. Like, I think Samsung has some level of integration, at least. LG, I believe, has it, which I think you use that, right?
Love my WebOS TV. It's the best.
Yeah. Also, GoGo Gate 2 and iSmart Gate. Provide some wireless sensors. Provide battery sensors for their wireless door sensors as well.
Excellent.
So if you got those are in there. Also, the Ream Econet products now have support for climate entities. So, you know, more climate goodness coming in.
That's awesome.
Never a bad thing.
All right, some breaking changes. Of course, there's some breaking changes. First of all, the Xiaomi Mio fans have been moved to the config flow. Now, if you have this set up in your YAML, it will be imported into the UI on startup, and then you can remove it from your YAML. Very interestingly, though, I know in the release notes it's flagged as the Xiaomi Mio fan. I actually have a Xiaomi Mio fan, which I got in Home Assistant via a custom component, so I was really excited to see this in the release notes, but when I plugged it in through the UI, I got an error from Home Assistant saying that my Xiaomi Mio fan was not recognized as a compatible device.
Oh, interesting.
But interestingly, I do have a Xiaomi Mio Wi-Fi switch that has now come in to my UI. I don't remember seeing that previously, so I have a feeling that this Xiaomi Mio change may not just be for fans, it may be for other Wi-Fi devices that you may have linked. Right. Through YAML, so just watch out for that one.
Well, that's one way to find out that your platform's not supported is when it's broken. You're like, oh,
yeah. So luckily, but if anyone's, I will leave a link to that custom component for the Xiaomi Mio fan that I've got running. It's perfect. I've no complaints with it. For whatever reason, the official Home Assistant image doesn't support it, but yeah, there is a custom component to fill that gap.
Nice. And kind of along the same theme, Google Cast, so the YAML configuration for the Google Cast integration is moving to the UI as well. So that'll be fully removed as of 2021.6. So you should be, you can still run with it for a little bit until you update to that in June.
On the Google Cast integration, I think they've added in, I remember skimming the release notes, and I think there is auto discovery now for Google Cast entities in Home Assistant now. So you may not need to, you know, specify, you know, hosts to target to. I could be making this up, but that's from my understanding of just skimming the notes. I'm guessing this would also tie in well with the media browser that Home Assistant has now. So, you know, you can hit that little cast button from within Home Assistant and it will, you know, detect all those Google Cast entities on your network that you can cast to.
That's amazing. Yeah, if that's the case, that would be awesome.
And as I mentioned before, the updated component that's, you know, got to remove those those YAML options for sending usage data back to Home Assistant. And also, Gritty is gone. So ERCOT shut down a layer Gritty after the massive power mess in Texas in mid-February. So I'm assuming Gritty was some form of electricity monitoring service for users. So that's gone and dusted.
Yeah. So last week when we spoke to Paulus as well, he also talked about something else cool coming around the corner.
We already have in the backend, but we're not going to make it for the UI for the April release is debugging. So breakpoints. So for the non-developers that are listening, a breakpoint is you mark a spot in your code, and when the computer is executing that program runs to that spot, it will pause and it will allow the developer to look what is happening, what's the value of each variable, and then allows you to kind of step into the program line by line as it's being executed to see what's happening and to really see like every little piece, and maybe you can influence the state machine so you know that the next condition is going to pass, these kind of things. And so in the automation world, in Home Assistant, what will happen is that you can actually mark certain actions as a breakpoint. And then when it gets to these actions, it will pause. And then you can actually, the same thing as like when you're debugging a program, you can step through it and like take every step.
Yeah.
Right.
That's cool. Like the developer in me really is like very excited for this.
Yeah. Well, the non-developer in me is very excited for this because that's usually why I'm spending weeks on something, you know, very trivial, right?
Yeah. And so I think this is going to be really, really cool. And what I hope is that, you know, everybody will be able to write better automations. Yeah. And then this will also mean that people can write better blueprints. And then we can share those blueprints. And then even more people can benefit from all the hard work that we're doing.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, like debugging and all that, I know you mentioned that there's it's not going to be in one of the April releases. Is there, obviously everything relates back to a YAML automation, so will the UI have support for, you know, being able to trace a UI the same as if someone had written a automation in YAML? Because
what happens is that even an automation written in the UI is actually structurally the same as an automation written in YAML. Sometimes there's a little bit more constraints. The UI will actually have a subset of what is possible in YAML.
Sure.
So, but in the end, it's the same engine running the same code. So a trace will work for both automations. The only requirement is that the automation has an ID. So the UI will automatically add IDs to automations.
Yeah.
And if you define them in YAML, you should start adding an ID to your automations. Because that's being used to, you know, keep track of the traces and link them back to the automations.
Yeah. Okay. That's a hot tip there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean it's going to be super cool. I think that you know, automations, like, it will be easier than ever before to figure out what's going wrong. And
sure,
reduce the pain points I think users are having, you know, like, you know, why didn't this automation work, but the frustrations, right?
And
Clearly, like, there are ways around it already, but the more frustrations people you can remove, right, the better, right?
Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the Eufy Video Lock. It's a smart lock that's really easy to set up with just a Phillips screwdriver and no extra drilling. It's got a keyless entry, so you don't need to worry about fumbling with the keys when your hands are full. Also, you don't need to worry about handing out extra keys when you're in a pinch, your kids losing them, or people copying the key and passing it around to each other. Something else I like about the Eufy Video Lock is that it has a camera built in and it works as a doorbell as well. Personally, I think the Eufy Video Lock is great for apartments or cottages where you can't necessarily add extra holes for a video doorbell. My favorite part about it, though, is that there isn't a monthly fee and your recordings are locally stored, so you don't have to worry about someone else owning your doorbell data. You can find it on Amazon, or if you want to know more, search Eufy Video Lock, that's EUFY Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
We've always talked about how we want to make things easier. And, you know, people are always afraid that we're taking the YAML away as being, you know, that's what it means. Yeah. But, you know, that's not the case here, is that we're actually, you know, enhancing however you write your automations, you can have great insight in it and write better automations. Yeah.
Yep, makes sense.
All right. And the cloud strikes again. So we saved it to the end this time. So Xiaomi Yeelight, so Home Assistant released an alert in the last week, basically for the firmware updates for Yeelight manufactured Xiaomi bulbs. So
just to be a bit confusing, right? Like,
Right? I you know what? I didn't even realize that Yeelight manufactures Xiaomi. They may actually be the same company. I have no idea. But
that's what I assume too. They've got a pretty close relationship. I just assume they're all the one, right? Like,
you would think, but
like Aquara and all that is like just Xiaomi, right? I'd assume Yeelight was another version of that.
Those are at least Xiaomi brands, right? Like Xiaomi Aquara or actually. Yeah, I think it is. But like the Xiaomi Mi, right? Whatever, yeah, right? Yeah. So maybe Yeelight is and I'm just misinformed. Who knows? So, but Xiaomi has basically said, hey, we want local controls to be restricted since it's a little bit risky, in their words. So it sounds like Yeelight wasn't the one making the decision. It sounds like it was Xiaomi. But basically, if you have any of these light bulbs, check alerts.homeassistant.io. There's a thread and it talks about how to install ESP Home onto the devices, which, I mean, if you listen to our last episode, that is now part of the Home Assistant project.
Mm.
You know, there's a way to install ESP Home on that, and that should work for you, hopefully. So they are, as far as we know, they're Wi-Fi connected bulbs, and the Zigbee devices shouldn't be affected, since kind of the point of Zigbee is to keep everything kind of local, right? So,
you know, I've said it again, I'll say it again, this is why I try and avoid Wi-Fi like the devil, right? Like, it is, any device that talks Wi-Fi is just a firmware update away from being bricked and unusable in your local environment, so... Zigbee, Z-Wave, you know, all those Bluetooth, any local protocol, that's fine. But Wi-Fi, I don't know. It's same with a TP-Link, right? Like, it's just that all over again. You have to end up blocking them, which is, you know, something that we actually spoke to once again with Paulus last week about, you know, just this whole, you know, manufacturers, you know, becoming, you know, sort of more security conscious and locking down their sort of local control of things. But, and Paulus had some interesting things to say about that.
On that, I mean, the three of us have kind of talked about this both online and offline in terms of, you know, organizations coming and starting to open up. How are you seeing that going? Like, are you seeing more organizations, as you have these conversations, are you seeing more organizations saying, hey, yeah, fine, you know what, you're right, let me let's whether open up an exclusive API for Home Assistant, or let's do fine, we'll open up our API in general. Like, what does that look like?
So, I mean, we're having some of these conversations. I think that the problem we have is that there's this stigma around open source, that it's small, that it's irrelevant.
Mm. Yeah.
Even, like, they only think open source is relevant if there is a well-known brand behind it, right? So, yeah, Chrome is open source, Firefox is open source, Linux is open source. Yeah, we know this. So, yeah, we take it seriously. But it doesn't mean that they know what it means. And so we actually see a lot of companies that are maybe aware of our existence, but then they don't really realize it. But then sometimes they do realize it because they mess up. So TP-Link, right? So TP-Link had a... they removed their local API, and then a lot of customers called in. It doesn't work anymore with Home Assistant. And they were like, well, never. What is Home Assistant?
Yeah.
So, you know, I actually got on a call with TP-Link last month, and we discussed this, and they were like, you know, it's funny, they initially reached out to me saying, yeah, we saw that Home Assistant integrates with TP-Link, but it does this based on like some code that was found on GitHub and this is not an official API.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I had to tell them, like, well, we're also code that is found on GitHub.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, they were like, okay, okay. And so, I mean, they are a big corporation. So they're working on sure. something. So, I mean, for TP-Link, for example, they said that they might have, and they're going to have a partner-only local API, which fucking dumb, of course. Sorry, my language, but...
Yeah. Yeah.
We can feel the frustration, right?
Yeah, it's just, but anyway, they're going to have Home Assistant. They want to have Home Assistant as a partner and like implemented API. And I mean, in the end of the day, we're open source, so anyone can see that API.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes, because that's actually a big blocker a lot of the times, is that
yeah.
all these companies want exclusivity because they are very afraid that they are creating value that they're not capturing themselves. So,
sure.
They don't want to have, you know, if they create a product and then they want to have a product that provides some automation based on like the data that their other devices capture. Well, if Home Assistant can do it better, now they're competing with Home Assistant because they had this open API.
Right.
If they never have this open API, they wouldn't have to compete with Home Assistant or every other home automation platform. But of course, their product is also less popular because they don't have an open API. Right, it's like
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. It's chicken and egg almost, right?
Yeah, but if you look at the big corporations, is that they all work like this, right? I mean, Google and Amazon, who are just like throwing around like these minis, their mini assistants for basically free or like very little money. The only way to integrate right now is to have a cloud-based API and implement their cloud-based API, right?
Yeah.
So they're working on open standardization, and that definitely will help. But yeah, I think talking to more companies, we see, you know, it's actually nice because the ESP chips are so cheap. We mm-hmm. see a lot of companies basing their software on like the ESP8266 and now moving towards ESP32. And those would tend to be, because there's, especially the ESP8266, because there's sort of a little space on it. They tend to be usually easily to crack or flash, yeah. or right. There was like Tuya Convert, so Tuya had all these devices, and people would put open source firmware on it. That's kind of going like Tuya has like fixed their stuff to not be able to do that anymore, which is too bad. But in the void, actually, some companies have stepped in, and the one that I generally reference because we work a lot with them is Shelly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is a Bulgarian company, but they sell ESP8266 and they're also moving to ESP32 based devices, but they actually allow you to flash it. So the Shelly relay has just accessible headers, and they say this is how you can put your own firmware on it. And there's actually an ESP home based firmware available.
That's great.
Yeah. And I mean, but you don't actually have to flash it to begin with because they have a local push API. So they will actually let Home Assistant know when something changes. So there's even it's not super necessary to flash it to begin with. But it's just very cool that they are thinking about this and they are working with this. And I actually, you know, they provide the people work on the integration with all the devices they need. And the engineers are open for updating the firmware so the integration is better with Home Assistant. And I hope that we can see more of these kind of companies step up, being like, we know people want to, like, if you have to install a relay behind your light switch, you're obviously not a basic user, right?
This is,
you need to be more advanced anyway. So you can already require some more technical knowledge from your users.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree there. And I think, you know, you bring up a good point, right? Is, at the end of the day, I mean, a company like Shelly or even Tuya, they are mostly a hardware company, right? I mean, I'm not sure if they do monetize some of their cloud stuff or anything else some other way, but, you know, it's at its heart, it's a hardware company, right? So to me, I would say, I mean, given the choice, I would pick Shelly because, I mean, between these two cases, right? Because, I mean, it is open, it is whatever, and it's still hardware, right? So they're still getting the revenue of that hardware in my eyes. But.
Right, and it, like the as a consumer, the choice is also easy because local APIs tend to not break because they will remain working, right? The vendor has to do active work to break a local API.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually another thing where, you know, we're like, oh, what is Home Assistant working on? I want to better educate the users about how the long-term impact of your IoT product, like how you can use it. So if a product relies on the cloud, then you have to look into how is this cloud funded.
Yeah.
Because if there's no funding for the cloud, like there's these light bulbs you can pick up for like $7-$8. They connect to Wi-Fi, they connect to Google Assistant, Amazon. I'm like, okay, who pays for this light bulb that is like almost cost at the price of the hardware, sold at the price of the hardware it would create to make? And it's like, yeah, I mean, how this is permanently connected to the cloud because it has to always receive commands from Google, and like that just doesn't work, right? And if we can tell people, don't buy these cheap things because it just sucks, then I hope that like, the, you know, it will also, manufacturers will start to notice that certain things don't sell, right? Because I think what I feel, what I notice in just general in society now is that we, you know, it used to be that there used to be very few manufacturers of every product. And so those, they were all very good at it. And they were like, you know, but they were pricey, but high quality. And now there's just a lot of cheap alternatives of a lot of different products. And they're just shitty and they fall apart. But you don't see that per se in the store. Right. But then you use them a couple of times. And you're like, oh, this doesn't work anymore, et cetera. Yeah, I feel like if as we teach consumers about IoT devices, like just buy stuff that's local, buy stuff that can keep working, and then it's better in the long run. And like not all cloud products are bad. Like sometimes it's some things just would require cloud because they do a lot of computation that cannot be done on the edge, at least yet. But at least then see who pays for that cloud. Like if you pay a monthly subscription for something, clouds are fine. You know that that's how it's covered, right? They don't have to read out your data. They don't just go away if they cannot sell more products or something, right?
Sure. Hopefully, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's when I see like, you know, like a Google Home Mini or something. And I'm like, well, you know that they're using this data to learn from you. Like, why else would it just be free?
Of course.
Like,
that's it, yeah. If you're not paying for it, then you're the product, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and it's funny because I was reading this the other day. Sometimes even if you are paying for it, you're still the product, right? But I mean, we've seen this kind of stuff, again, happen over and over and over again. I mean, Logitech is a great example of just how they just really ticked off the entire community by just being like, yeah, you know what? You got this? Too bad. Right? Well, it's going to be bricked as of whenever.
There was this this device that people were, Circuit, I think it was called, or Cricket. It was a device just like last month. They decided it's for making like custom mugs and stuff like this. You could cut out like fabric and like they decided that if you want to work on more than three projects at the same time, you had to pay a $10 a month subscription, even though you already bought the device and stuff. And people were pissed off. And then now, of course, they reverted it after like a month of like everybody being like pissed.
I also get it's like, hey, listen, our costs are going up. So from this point forward, if you want to do blah, 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 cool, right? Like, fine. Yeah. I could see that, right? But yeah, that's definitely not a tactful way of doing things.
No, it's not. It's like Belkin and their Wemo. They like put out a firmware saying, you can't use local access anymore. And then after, you know, saying, you know, their whole advertising pitch was, we will never charge a monthly subscription during the pandemic, of course, you know, no one's buying any of these devices, so they can't fund their servers, and same thing, right? We're going to have to charge a monthly fee now, right?
Yeah,
so. Right. Yeah, I think, it sucks, but we're going to see it happen more and more often. I mean, I always like to give the example of a company that does it well is Signify or Philips Hue Lights.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. They actually have a page on their website saying there is remote control and like Google, like that cloud part of our hub, you can... it's guaranteed that 1 year from purchase, this or 2 years from purchase, this will remain working and potentially longer. So I think their first hub worked for like 7 years or something. But at least they're clear about it. They're honest.
That's true.
I really wish more manufacturers would do that. Or even, I mean, I actually just want a law to be passed that like, you know, you have to guarantee users or tell users honestly how long you're planning to offer cloud if it's being sold.
Because there's like we've seen it. I think there was those car monitoring tracking devices that shut down April last year, right? They just said, "Oh, we're closing down. We're shutting off our servers. Don't send the devices back to us. Just chuck them in the bin," basically, right? And so there's all that e-waste, and people have put hundreds of dollars into these devices, and now they can't use them anymore, right? Like, so it's going to become a bigger issue definitely.
Yeah, there's definitely an environmental impact too, right? In terms of, to your point, Phil, all the e-waste that gets generated because, you know, somebody decided, yeah, I don't want to be in this business anymore. I don't want to do whatever.
But. Right. But yeah, sometimes it's also, you know, it's when it comes to like cheap devices, like it's a luxury to be able to afford more expensive devices, right? Like if you are, like there's many light bulbs in your house. If you are putting 10, 20 light bulbs in your house, then all of a sudden like $3 or $10 more is a lot of money.
Sure. Yeah. Sure it is, right? And, and that multiplies just more and more and more, right?
Yeah. And I think that's so the,
you know, I think there has to be some kind of balance, right? I think between cost of device to, you know, the value of it, right? Like,
I have high hopes for chip because of this, because there's many, like, you know, if Google and Amazon or Apple are all involved with chip, so if they start speaking chip, then a lot of more manufacturers will be incentivized to use chip. For the readers that are not listening, chip stands for connected home over IP. It's a new home automation standard that's being developed under the Zigbee umbrella. So it's like a spiritual successor to Zigbee, one could say. And they're actually developing reference implementation together with it. So including like an ESP32 firmware. So what would happen is that if you are a Chinese manufacturer and, you know, you like making cheap products but don't want to bother with software, you could actually just put a chip in it and take the open source implementation, and you have a product you can sell. And that means that we can have very cheap light bulbs with just local chip APIs that don't need any cloud. And we kind of like, you know, this whole topic that we keep discussing every month in the podcast, right? Can become a thing of the past.
I mean, well, that we can give also, something to talk about, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there will be, because the thing with the standard is that if you want to differentiate yourself as a manufacturer, you now need to go beyond the standard. So all of a sudden you can either say, I don't implement the standard, or the standard can be used to control parts of my product, but you still need my app and my cloud to do other things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they will break that.
Well, and you get, that's why if you look at Zigbee, there's all of these discrepancies, right? Between what something as simple as a motion sensor can do. Right?
Oh no, for sure. But I think that will be nice if it's all standardized, in that like it will, if they all use the same software, it should be more the same, but they'll find a way to mess it up.
Yeah, well, and that's it, right? And I don't know, like for me, I'm also a little skeptical when these new protocols come out, right? Because I mean, you think of how long Zigbee, Z-Wave have been around, but I mean, Google, who's also working on chip, is also, you know, they also had Thread, right? Which
Wave or something as well.
Weave.
Yeah.
Sorry, not Thread. Yeah.
I was about to say, because chip uses Thread. So there's different, there's the radio itself. On top of it, Thread is the mesh protocol, how messages are being sent around.
Yeah.
And then chip is the application layer on top that describes the capabilities and the control commands. So, hey, my light is on. Chip will tell you I'm a light, I'm on. Thread will send that message via nodes to the controllers. But chip will also work over Wi-Fi. Chip will also work over Bluetooth. They're like predefining this from the beginning already. Mm-hmm. Like this is how it's all supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, point is there's all of these different protocols that ends up being, develop, right? And you know, hopefully, you know, people are able to actually standardize on it, and we say, okay, like similar to how we standardized on IP in the networking world and said, okay, you know what, we're going to stick to this model, and then, you know, there are transitions happening there too, but even then it's, you know, with IPv4, IPv6, things like that, okay, let's give a nice easy way to transition this at a software layer, right? So
the transition that is gonna I know. So Silicon Labs, which is the company that owns Z-Wave, and it's and it's I think they produce like 70% of the world's Zigbee chips.
Yeah,
they are obviously also involved with chip, but they are actually working on a co-processor, a chip that you can put in your product that can speak Zigbee and chip at the same time. And because if you think about it, Philips Hue and IKEA cannot just start selling chip lights. They need to be compatible with all their old lights for like pretty much forever, right? If you have invested, especially in the Philips Hue ecosystem, that stuff is expensive, right? Yeah. You need to, the gateway you buy needs to keep working with it. So
yeah,
they will not launch until they can be compatible with both protocols at the same time. And so that transition will take a long time because, we have invested in our houses already, right? We can't just like throw all that stuff away.
Sure. And sometimes it's, several thousands of dollars worth of worth exactly. of stuff, right? And so, it's tough, but
If you look at the new all the new stuff that Google is launching, so they just announced a new Google Nest Hub with a display.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It actually has a Thread chip in it.
Interesting.
And I think that they're I might be wrong on this, but I think that their Wi-Fi mesh also has Thread chips in it. So they want to be able to also create a Thread mesh in your house to help you get all this data. But of course, they want to have that chip data instead of like Home Assistant.
Yeah.
But
it will be
it would still be good if they just become routers and just like repeat all those messages until they hit the controller, and then Home Assistant can be that controller. That would be the best.
Yeah. They'll be like little nodes so they can increase range and
So there's a lot of cool stuff coming out. I mean, I feel this industry is still very, very, very young, and we're finally getting to more sensible standards and then adopting those standards. I mean, if you think about like having Philips Hue and IKEA like build those compatible gateways and all this, I mean, we're talking years, not like months, right?
Totally.
But it's going to be freaking cool.
Yeah. Hopefully there's some authority around this too, right? Not authority, but like a way of organizing these again, like whether it's like an IETF or some kind of standards body that says, okay, this is how we're going to develop
so
from here on.
So this is the Zigbee Alliance is like taking care of this.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
But then even any modifications, again, now Zigbee Alliance deals with Zigbee and Thread and that kind of world. And then there's 18 other ones that,
end up popping up,
right? So.
Yeah, I think Zigbee always had the problem that there was no strict certification. Like anyone else that had the Zigbee compatibility could claim Zigbee compatibility. And Z-Wave always had a single vendor.
Mm.
Now, that's also the reason why everybody's using Zigbee, because no big corporation is going to buy a chip that has only one manufacturer, because they can raise up the prices and you're lost.
Yep. Or tomorrow shut down and guess what? Your product is dead.
Yep.
Right, exactly. So... yeah, for a better world, there will be.
That's right. All right, Rohan. So on to some, I guess, other stuff, now that we've got our release out the way. I think the flavor of the month has really been about Node-RED with you and I. We've been talking back and forwards. With the past few guests we've had on, they've been talking about Node-RED. I know my inbox has been flooded with people's, in their disbelief of my... lack of enthusiasm around Node-RED. So, Rohan, you've actually taken the plunge. Tell me about your recent experience with Node-RED.
Yeah, so I want to backtrack, and it was a couple of reasons, right? So one was, again, because to Phil's point, I was right there with him going, not that I was against Node-RED, I just didn't care for it. And instead, I was using the built-in home automation. I was using the built-in Home Assistant YAML-based automations and everything. And a colleague of mine basically talked to me about it, and he was like, hey, man, check it out, play with it, do whatever. And this last week, I just took the week off, so, I had a bit of free time. So I said, all right, why not? Let's actually try this. So currently, outside of my webhooks, which I have, I think, like two maybe or maybe three, all of my other automations have basically moved into Node-RED, including some that I couldn't get working. With YAML. So a couple of things I learned, it is very easy to make these flows and to create these automations, and simple automations obviously are, as the name suggests, simple. Whereas even the complex ones, I found it just easier to think out, as I'm drawing it out, being like, okay, what do I want to do? I'm still learning some of the constructs in Node-RED and just trying to say, okay, would I use this or is there a better way to do this? So in no way am I saying that my flows are efficient, but a lot of, they all work. And a couple of the ones actually that I found was I wasn't able to get working in the past just because it was complex, even from the YAML perspective. So as an example, one of them was I want to open my door. like my back door that leads into my patio, if I leave it open for more than 3 minutes, kill the echo bee, and then if I close it again, then put it back to the state it was in, right? Okay. So I very rarely use the auto feature. I typically do heat or cool.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I don't want, you know, the AC running, just in case it is in, like AC running in the winter or the heater running in the summer, yeah, just because the temperature fluctuates a little bit or whatever. So I like to hard set it, but then, you know, I don't want to change my automation every time spring or fall or whatever rolls around. So whatever I had it set to, I wanted to go back to that. Got that working. You know, it did take a little bit of kind of drawing out and you know, I haven't really, I know there are ways to do like subflows and things like that. It's like a flow within a flow. I didn't do any of those yet, but got it working. Works beautifully, actually.
How's the, I'm guessing you're very impressed with the reset time, right? You just click I think it's a reload button or something, and then bam, your automations are alive, right? No needing to restart Home Assistant, wait for all the entities to repopulate or anything like that.
Exactly. So there's a little deploy button that's kind of on the top right of the screen. You click that and all of a sudden it's there. And what's really cool is, I mean, we're talking about breakpoints and we're talking about all this stuff. There's actually ways to inject a specific thing. So like I can force a trigger. So as an example, I can just click and drag another node, which can basically, I can just, it's called an inject node. So I can just press the button that comes with it, and I can simulate my door opening, my door closing, things like that too. Which I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah. So it'll allow you to debug your automations and all that pretty nicely.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, bunch of other things too, right? Like, it actually steps you through the automation as it's happening. I mean, sometimes it does go pretty quickly, but it is still pretty, I mean, you could add delays and things like that in there too, right? So just at least while you look at it, you can delay things like that. So, you know what, overall, I am definitely impressed. I think I will probably stick to Node-RED. I haven't found a reason to go back to it. I know one of the other things is there's also, you know, people that can create these nodes, I guess is a term.
Yep.
Which is basically, you know, the function that does whatever, right? So I imported a couple of custom ones for like time ranges, or like to say, like, you know, between or trigger and on at this time, trigger and off at that time, that kind of thing. Yeah, works really well, and it seems to be pretty extensible. So I know there is one for webhooks that I want to get, and I'll probably move those over too. And
yeah,
actionable notifications work beautifully.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so
I remember seeing there was a type of node option, like a traffic light. I can't remember the terminology, but there's a traffic light little component that you can add in, and you know, you can, you know, put in like, you know, if a door's open, you know, it flicks that traffic light from, you know, go to stop and all that. So
yeah, exactly.
I can see the powerfulness there. It's just in terms of the way I think of automations, I can just see like a lot of entry points and things go like spaghetti going everywhere, right? So. But do whatever works for you, I guess.
Exactly. Like the spaghetti piece was kind of my concern at first. But I guess as you build it out, it actually makes a lot of sense. If I look at somebody else's, I don't know that it would. Maybe it will. Maybe I will now. But, you know, I think in the past when I didn't really use Node-RED, I was kind of looking at it and I'm like, okay, what is this, right? Like, as in, I can see it visually, yes, but I don't know necessarily what's happening or things like that. So, but you know what? It actually works very, very, very well. And the nice thing is I don't have to putz with some of these, like the Jinja 2 templates and things like that anymore. I think those were what really put me off of the YAML automations. Just by virtue of me being me, I'm just very bad at those in general. So
how do you find the general speed in terms of Home Assistant and Node-RED communication? Like if you open a door, is there a delay that you've noticed in the automation firing?
No, it's pretty much on point. One thing I did notice is one of my automations, which is turn on, I think it's just my, was it my good evening one? It might've been my good evening one. It, It didn't fire on the, like, so it depends on sunset, right? So the time changes. So today it was 7:15 on PM.
Yep.
So, but it it triggered at like 7:15:20 instead of 7:15:00. But that's not a Home Assistant and Node-RED communication issue. That's just a thing. So, and I'm sure there's ways I can tweak it, and it might actually, that was actually one of the custom nodes that I installed called SCEDX.
Okay.
SCEDX, yeah. So it might be a facet of that, right?
Yep.
Where I think I can actually even probably specify as like just a seconds, but in my case I can't, just because I have it as at like a trigger is sunset start is the actual terms, right? So
yeah, and that can be very variable based on the angle of the sun, I'm guessing, as well, right?
But what's neat is I can actually see what time that will trigger, right?
Oh, so, interesting.
So if I, let's say tomorrow morning, I go in and look, so I actually do sunset start minus 30 minutes.
Yep.
So I can see that today that was 7:15 PM. And even if I checked this morning, it would have said 7:15 PM.
Mm.
Right. So, actually right now it's, sorry, every time I said 7:15 was actually wrong. That was the upcoming one.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Because it is technically tomorrow for me. Right now, it's about 12:53 in the morning. So yeah, so I know tomorrow at 7:15 PM that's going to get called, right? Today, just looking at times that everything else was triggered, 7:41 was the time. So, point is, it's really easy to decipher these kind of things.
Yes.
Right? Yep. Which I think is, to me, that's a really nice thing there.
Have you had to start using any JavaScript code or anything like that? Because I know, like YAML has your Jinja templates, Node has, your JavaScript code that you can then customize down further if you need to, that, a special node can't decipher for you. Have you had to do anything like that yet?
Not yet. And if I did, I'd probably just find something that somebody's done in the past and copy and paste it. If not, I give up. No. I haven't, right? If I'm trying to do something that complex, where I need that, so far from everything I'm doing, and I've said this a few times on the show, like my automations are fairly simple, I think, right? The one I described earlier with the Ecobee going back to its old status or whatever, that was probably one of the more complicated ones I've gotten. That's not even that complex.
Yep.
Unless that changes at some point, I don't see that being a thing.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm overall pretty happy with it.
Well, I'll check in with you in a couple of releases and see how you're going.
Yeah.
All right, Rohan, I think that's going to wrap us up for today. See everyone next release.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Cheers.
If you want to share your Home Assistant journey or come on as a guest, reach out to us at feedback@hasspodcast.io. That's hasspodcast.io.
The Home Assistant podcast is hosted by Phil Hawthorne and myself, Rohan Karamandi. For links to topics that we discussed today, check out our show notes on haspodcast.io.